The old thrill, the sense of battle, consumed him. It did not enrage him, as it did some men, but everything seemed to become clearer, crisper. His muscles moved easily, he breathed more deeply. He came alive. He leaped backward as the creatures pressed at him. With a kick, he knocked over the table, tumbling it at one of the beasts. He drove the poker at the open maw of the other. As he had hoped, the inside of its mouth was sensitive. The creature let out a pained hiss and scrambled back. Dalinar moved to the overturned table and kicked off one of the legs. He scooped it up, falling into Smokestance's knife form. He used the wooden leg to fend off one creature, while he thrust three times at the face of the other, ripping a gash in its cheek that bled smoke. It came out as a hiss. There were distant screams outside. "Blood of my fathers," he thought. "These aren't the only two." He needed to be done, and quickly. If the fight dragged on, they'd wear him down faster than he wore them down. Who even knew if beasts like this got tired? Bellowing, he jumped forward. Sweat streamed from his forehead, and the room seemed to grow just faintly darker. Or no more focused. Just him and the beasts. The only wind was that of his weapons spinning, the only sound that of his feet hitting the floor, the only vibration that of his heart thumping. His sudden whirlwind of blows shocked the creatures. He smashed the table leg against one, forcing it back, then threw himself at the other one, earning a rake of the claws against his arm as he rammed the poker into the beast's chest. The skin resisted at first, but then broke, his poker moving through easily after that. A powerful jet of smoke burst out around Dalinar's hand. He pulled his arm free, and the creature stumbled back, legs growing thinner, body deflating like a leaking wineskin. He knew he'd exposed himself in attacking. There was nothing to do but throw his arm up as the other beast leapt on him, slashing his forehead and his arm, biting his shoulder. Dalinar screamed, slamming the table leg again and again at the beast's head. He tried forcing the creature back, but it was terribly strong. So Dalinar let himself slip to the ground and kicked upward, tossing the beast over his head. The fangs ripped free of Dalinar's shoulder with a spray of blood. The beast hit the floor in a mess of black legs. Dizzy, Dalinar forced himself to his feet and fell into his stance. "Always keep the stance." The creature got to its feet at about the same time, and Dalinar ignored the pain, ignored the blood, letting the thrill give him focus. He leveled the poker. The table leg had fallen from his blood-slick fingers. The beast crouched, then charged. Dalinar let the fluid nature of Smokestance direct him, stepping to the side and smashing the poker into the beast's legs. It tripped as Dalinar turned around, wielding his poker with both hands and slamming it directly down into the creature's back. The powerful blow broke the skin, passed through the creature's body, and hit the stone floor. The creature struggled, legs working ineffectively as smoke hissed out the holes in its back and stomach. Dalinar stepped away, wiping blood from his forehead, leaving the weapon to fall to the side and clang to the ground, still impaling the beast.
"Three gods, Heb," the woman whispered.
He turned to find her looking completely shocked as she stared at the deflating carcasses.
"I should have helped," she mumbled. "Should have grabbed something to hit them. But you were so fast. It was just a few heartbeats. Where? How?"
She focused on him.
"I've never seen anything like it, Heb. You fought like one of the Radiants themselves. Where did you learn that?"
Dalinar didn't answer. He pulled off his shirt, grimacing as the pain of his wounds returned. Only the shoulder was immediately dangerous, but it was bad. His left arm was growing numb. He ripped the shirt in half, tying one portion around his gashed right forearm, then wadded the rest and pressed it against his shoulder. He walked over and pulled the poker free of the deflated body, which now resembled a black silk sack. Then he moved to the window. The other homes showed signs of being attacked, fires burning, faint screams hanging on the wind.
"We need to get someplace safe," he said. "Is there a cellar nearby?"
"A what?"
"Cave in the rock, man-made or natural.
No caves, the woman said, joining him at the window. How would men make a hole in the rock?
With a shard blade or a soul caster. Or even with basic mining. Though that could be difficult, as the Krem would seal up caverns and high storm rains made for an extremely potent risk of flooding. Dalinar looked out the window again. Dark shapes moved in the moonlight. Some were coming in their direction. He wavered, dizzy. Blood loss. Gritting his teeth, he steadied himself against the frame of the window. How long was this vision going to last? We need a river. Something to wash away the trail of our scent. Is there one nearby? The woman nodded, growing pale-faced as she noticed the dark forms in the night. Get the girl, woman.
The girl? Seelie, our daughter. And since one of you called me woman, is Taffa so hard to say? Stormwind's Heb, what has gotten into you?
He shook his head, moving to the door and throwing it open, still carrying the poker. Bring the lamp. The light won't give us away. I don't think they can see. The woman obeyed, hurrying to collect Seelie. She looked to be about 6 or 7, then followed Dalinar out, the clay lamp's fragile flame quivering in the night. It looked a little like a slipper. The river? Dalinar asked.
You know where...
I hit my head, Taffa, Dalinar said. I'm dizzy, it's hard to think. The woman looked worried at that, but seemed to accept this answer. She pointed away from the village. Let's go, he said, moving out into the darkness. Are attacks by these beasts common?
During desolations, perhaps, but not in my life. Stormwinds, Heb. We need to get you to...
No, he said. We keep moving. They continued along a path which ran up toward the backside of the wave formation. Dalinar kept glancing back at the village. How many people were dying below, murdered by those beasts from damnation? Where were the landlord's soldiers? Perhaps this village was too remote, too far from a city lord's direct protection. Or perhaps things didn't work that way in this era, this place. I'll see the woman and child to the river, then I'll return to organize a resistance, if anyone is left. The thought seemed laughable. He had to use the poker to keep himself upright. How was he going to organize a resistance? He slipped on a steep portion of the trail and Taffa set down the lamp, grabbing his arm, concerned. The landscape was rough with boulders and rock buds, their vines and leaves extended in the cool, wet night. Those rustled in the wind. Dalinar righted himself, then nodded to the woman, gesturing for her to continue. A faint scraping sounded in the night. Dalinar turned, tense.
Heb?
The woman asked, sounding afraid. Hold up the light. She raised the lamp, illuminating the hillside in flickering yellow. A good dozen midnight patches, skins too smooth, were creeping over rock buds and boulders. Even their teeth and claws were black. Seelie whimpered, pulling close to her mother. Run, Dalinar said softly, raising his poker.
Heb, they're...
Run, he bellowed.
They're in front of us, too.
He spun, picking out the dark patches ahead. He cursed, looking around. There, he said, pointing to a nearby rock formation. It was tall and flat. He shoved Taffa forward and she towed Seelie, their single-piece blue dresses rippling in the wind. They ran more quickly than he could in his state, and Taffa reached the rock wall first. She looked up, as if to climb to the top. It was too steep for that. Dalinar just wanted something solid to put at his back. He stepped onto a flat, open section of rock before the formation and raised his weapon. Black beasts crawled carefully over the stones. Could he distract them somehow and let the other two flee? He felt so dizzy. What I'd give for my shard plate. Seelie whimpered. Her mother tried to comfort her, but the woman's voice was unnerved. She knew. Knew those bundles of blackness, like living night, would rip them and tear them. What was that word she'd used? Desolation. The book spoke of them. the desolations had happened during the near-mythical shadow days, before real history began, before mankind had defeated the Voidbringers and taken the war to heaven. The Voidbringers. Was that what these things were? Myths. Myths come to life to kill him. Several of the creatures lunged forward, and he felt the thrills surge within him again, strengthening him as he swung. They jumped back, cautious, testing for weakness. Others sniffed the air, pacing. They wanted to get at the woman and child. Dalinar jumped at them, forcing them away, uncertain where he found the strength. One got close and he swung at it, falling into wind stance, as it was most familiar. The sweeping strikes. The grace. He struck at the beast, scoring it on its flank, but two others jumped at him from the side. Claws raked his back, and the weight threw him to the stones. He cursed, rolling, punching a creature and tossing it back. Another bit his wrist, causing him to drop the poker in a flash of pain. He bellowed and slammed his fist into the creature's jaw, and it opened reflexively, freeing his hand. The monsters pressed forward. Somehow he got to his feet and stumbled back against the rock wall. The woman threw the lamp at a creature that got too close, spraying oil across the stones and setting it alight. The fire didn't seem to bother the creatures. The move exposed Seely as Taffa fell off balance in the throw. A monster knocked her down, and others scrambled for the child. But Dalinar leaped for her, wrapping his arms around her, huddling down and turning his back on the monsters. One leaped on his back. Claws sliced his skin. Seely whimpered in terror. Taffa was screaming as the monsters overwhelmed her.
"Why are you showing me this?" Dalinar bellowed into the night. "Why must I live this vision, curse you?"
Claws raked his back. He clutched Seely, back arching in pain. He cast his eyes upward toward the sky. And there, he saw brilliant blue light falling through the air. It was like a star rock, dropping at an incredible speed. Dalinar cried out as the light hit the ground a short distance away, cracking the stone, spraying rock chips in the air. The ground shook. The beasts froze. Dalinar turned numbly to the side, then watched in amazement as the light stood up, limbs unfolding. It wasn't a star at all. It was a man. A man in glowing blue shard plate, bearing a shard blade, trails of stormlight rising from his body. The creatures hissed furiously, suddenly throwing themselves at the figure, ignoring Dalinar and the other two. The shardbearer raised his blade and struck forward with skill, stepping into the attacks. Dalinar lay stunned. This was unlike any shardbearer he had ever seen. The plate glowed with an even blue light, and glyphs, some familiar, others not, were etched into the metal. They trailed blue vapor. Moving fluidly, plate clinking, the man struck at the beasts. He effortlessly sheared a monster in half, flinging pieces into the night that trailed black smoke. Dalinar pulled himself to Taffa. She was alive, though her side was torn and flayed. Seely tugged at her, weeping.
"Need to do something,"
Dalinar thought dully.
"Be at peace," a voice said.
Dalinar lurched, turning to see a woman in delicate shard plate kneeling beside him, holding something bright. It was a topaz entwined with a heliodor, both set into a fine metal framework, each stone as big as a man's hand. The woman had light tan eyes that almost seemed to glow in the night, and she wore no helm. Her hair was pulled back into a bun. She raised a hand and touched his forehead. Ice washed across him. Suddenly his pain was gone. The woman reached out and touched Taffa. The flesh on her arm regrew in an eye blink. The torn muscle remained where it was, but other flesh just grew where the chunks had been torn out. The skin knitted up over it without flaw, and the female shardbearer wiped away the blood and torn flesh with a white cloth. Taffa looked up, awed.
"You came," she whispered. "Bless the Almighty."
The female shardbearer stood. Her armor glowed with an even amber light. She smiled and turned to the side, a shard blade forming from mist into her hand as she rushed to aid her companion. A woman shard bearer, Dalinar thought. He'd never seen such a thing. He stood up, hesitant. He felt strong and healthy, as if he'd just awakened from a good night's sleep. He glanced down at his arm, pulling off his makeshift bandage. He had to wipe free blood and some torn skin, but underneath, the skin was perfectly healed. He took a few deep breaths, then shrugged, picked up his poker, and joined the fight.
Heb?
Taffa called from behind.
Are you insane?
He didn't respond. He couldn't very well just sit there while two strangers fought to protect him. There were dozens of the black creatures. As he watched, one landed a scraping hit on the shardbearer in blue, and the claw scored the shard plate, digging into and cracking it. The danger to these shardbearers was real. The female shardbearer turned to Dalinar. She had her helm on now. When had she put it on? She seemed shocked as Dalinar threw himself at one of the black beasts, slashing it with his poker. He fell into smoke stance and fended against its counterattack. The female shardbearer turned to her companion, then the two of them fell into stances forming a triangle with Dalinar, his position closest to the rock formation. With two shardbearers alongside him, the fighting went remarkably better than it had back at the house. He only managed to dispatch a single beast. They were quick and strong, and he fought defensively, trying to distract and keep pressure off the shardbearers. The creatures did not retreat. They continued to attack until the last one was sliced in two by the female shardbearer. Dalinar stopped, puffing, lowering his poker. Other lights had fallen, and still were falling, from the sky in the direction of the village. Presumably, some of these strange shardbearers had landed there as well.
Well, a strong voice said, I must say that I've never before had the pleasure of fighting alongside a comrade with such unconventional means.
Dalinar turned to find the male shardbearer regarding him. Where had the man's helm gone? The shardbearer stood with his blade resting on his armored shoulder, and he inspected Dalinar with eyes of such bright blue they were almost white. Were those eyes actually glowing, leaking stormlight? His skin was dark brown like a makabaki, and he had short black curly hair. His armor no longer glowed, though one large symbol, emblazoned across the front of the breastplate, still gave off a faint blue light. Dalinar recognized the symbol, the particular pattern of the stylized double eye, eight spheres connected with two at the center. It had been the symbol of the Lost Radiance, back when they'd been called the Knights Radiant. The female shardbearer watched the village.
Who trained you in the sword?
The male knight asked Dalinar. Dalinar met the eyes of the knight. He had no idea how to respond.
This is my husband, Heb, good knight, Taffa said, rushing forward, leading her daughter by the hand. He's never seen a sword, far as I know.
Your stances are unfamiliar to me, the knight said. But they were practiced and precise. This level of skill comes only with years of training. I have rarely seen a man, knight or soldier, fight as well as you did.
Dalinar remained silent.
No words for me, I see, the knight said. Very well. But should you wish to put that mysterious training of yours to use, come to Urethiru.
Urethiru, Dalinar said. He'd heard that name somewhere.
Yes, the knight said. I cannot promise you a position in one of the orders. That decision is not mine. But if your skill with the sword is similar to your skill with hearth-tending implements, then I am confident you will find a place with us.
He turned eastward, toward the village.
Spread the word. Signs like this one are not without import. A desolation is coming.
He turned to his companion.
I will go. Guard these three and lead them to the village. We cannot leave them alone in the dangers of this night.
His companion nodded. The Blue Knight's armor began to glow faintly, then he launched himself into the air as if falling straight up. Dalinar stumbled back, shocked, watching the glowing blue figure rise, then arc downward toward the village.
"Come,"
the woman said, voice ringing inside her helm. She began to hurry down the incline.
"Wait,"
Dalinar said, hastening after her, Taffa scooping up her daughter and following. Behind them, the oil was burning out. The female knight slowed to allow Dalinar and Taffa to keep pace with her.
"I must know," Dalinar said, feeling foolish. "What year is it?"
The knight turned to him. Her helm was gone. He blinked. When had that happened? Unlike her companion, she had light skin, not pale like someone from Shinovar, but a natural light tan like an Alethi.
"It is 8th Epic, 337.
8th Epic," Dalinar thought. "What does that mean?"
This vision had been different from the others. They had been more brief, for one thing. And the voice that spoke to him, where was it?
"Where am I?" Dalinar asked the knight. "What kingdom?"
The knight frowned.
"Are you not healed?"
"I am well. I need to know. Which kingdom am I in?"
"This is Natanatan."
Dalinar released an inhaled breath.
Natanatan.
The shattered plains lay in the land that had once been Natanatan. The kingdom had fallen centuries ago.
"And you fight for Natanatan's king?"
he asked. She laughed.
"The Knights Radiant fight for no king and for all of them."
"Then where do you live?"
"Urethiru is where our orders are centered, but we live in cities all across Alethala."
Dalinar froze in place. Alethala. It was the historical name for the place that had become Alethkar.
"You cross kingdom borders to fight?"
"Heb,"
Taffa said. She seemed very concerned.
"You were the one who promised me that the Radiance would come protect us just before you went out searching for Seelie. Is your mind still muddled? Lady Knight, could you heal him again?" "I should save regrowth for others who might be wounded,"
the woman said, glancing at the village. The fighting seemed to be dying down.
"I'm fine," Dalinar said. Alethala. You live there?"
"It is our duty and our privilege," the woman said, "to stay vigilant for the desolation. One kingdom to study the arts of war, so that the others might have peace. We die so that you may live. It has ever been our place."
Dalinar stood still, sorting through that.
"All who can fight are needed," the woman said, "and all who have a desire to fight should be compelled to come to Alethala. Fighting, even this fighting against the 10 deaths, changes a person. We can teach you so that it will not destroy you. Come to us."
Dalinar found himself nodding.
"Every pasture needs 3 things, the woman said, voice changing as if she were quoting from memory. "Flocks to grow, herdsmen to tend, and watchers at the rim. We of Alethala are those watchers, the warriors who protect and fight. We maintain the terrible arts of killing, then pass them on to others when the desolation comes."
"The desolation," he said. "That means the Voidbringers, right? Those are what we fought this night?"
The knight sniffed dismissively.
"Voidbringers? These? No. This was Midnight Essence. The who released it is still a mystery."
She looked to the side, expression growing distant.
"Harkelane says the desolation is close, and he is not often wrong.
He..."
A sudden screaming sounded in the night. The knight cursed, looking toward it.
"Wait here. Call out if the essence returns," I will hear.
She dashed off into the darkness. Dalinar raised a hand, torn between following and staying to watch over Taffa and her daughter. Stormfather, he thought, realizing they'd been left in darkness now that the knight's glowing armor was gone. He turned back to Taffa. She stood on the trail beside him, eyes looking oddly distracted.
Taffa? He asked. I miss these times, Taffa said.
Dalinar jumped. That voice wasn't hers. It was a man's voice, deep and powerful. It was the voice that spoke to him during every vision.
Who are you?
Dalinar asked.
They were one once,
Taffa, or whatever it was, said.
The Orders. Men. Not without problems or strife, of course, but focused.
Dalinar felt a chill. Something about that voice always seemed faintly familiar to him. It had, even in the first vision.
Please, you have to tell me what this is. Why you are showing me these things. Who are you? Some servant of the Almighty?
I wish I could help you,
Taffa said, looking at Dalinar but ignoring his questions.
You have to unite them.
As you've said before, but I need help. The things the knight said about Alethkar, are they true? Can we really be that way again?
To speak of what might be is forbidden, the voice said. To speak of what was depends on perspective. But I will try to help.
Then give me more than vague answers.
Taffa regarded him, somber. Somehow, by starlight alone, he could make out her brown eyes. There was something deep, something daunting, hiding behind them.
At least tell me this, Dalinar said,
grasping for a specific question to ask.
I have trusted High Prince Sarius, but my son, Adolin, thinks I am a fool to do so. Should I continue to trust Sarius?
Yes, the being said. This is important. Do not let strife consume you. Be strong. Act with honor, and honor will aid you.
Finally, Dalinar thought, something concrete. He heard voices. The dark landscape around Dalinar grew vague.
No!
He reached for the woman.
Don't send me back yet. What should I do about Elikar and the war?
I will give you what I can.
The voice was growing indistinct.
I am sorry for not giving more.
What kind of answer is that?
Dalinar bellowed. He shook himself, struggling. Hands held him. Where had they come from? He cursed, batting them away, twisting, trying to break free. Then he froze. He was in the barrack at the Shattered Plains, soft rain rattling on the roof. The bulk of the storm had passed. A group of soldiers held Dalinar down, while Renarin watched with concern. Dalinar grew still, mouth open. He had been yelling. The soldiers looked uncomfortable, glancing at each other, not meeting his gaze. If it was like before, he'd have acted out his role in the vision, speaking in gibberish, flailing around.
My mind is clear now, Dalinar said. It's all right. You can all let me go.
Renarin nodded to the others, and they hesitantly released him. Renarin tried to make some stuttering excuses, telling them that his father was simply eager for combat. It didn't sound very convincing. Dalinar retreated to the back of the barrack, sitting down on the floor between two rolled-up bedrolls, just breathing in and out and thinking. He trusted the visions, yet his life in the war camps had been difficult enough lately without people presuming him mad.
Act with honor, and honor will aid you.
The vision had told him to trust Sadeus, but he'd never been able to explain that to Adolin, who not only hated Sadeus, but thought the visions were delusions from Dalinar's mind. The only thing to do was keep going as he had. And find a way somehow to get the High Princes to work together. 20. Scarlet. 7 years ago.
I can save her,
Cal said, pulling off his shirt. The child was only 5. She'd fallen far.
I can save her.
He was mumbling. A crowd had gathered. It had been 2 months since Bright Lord Wistio's death. They still didn't have a replacement City Lord. He had barely seen Laurel at all in that time. Cal was only 13, but he'd been trained well. The first danger was blood loss. The child's leg had broken, a compound fracture, and it was spurting red where bone had split the skin. Cal found his hands trembling as he pressed his fingers against the wound. The broken bone was slick, even the jagged end wetted by blood. Which arteries had been torn?
What are you doing to my daughter?
Thick-shouldered Harl pushed through the onlookers.
You Kremling! You Storm's Leavings! Don't touch me, Asel! Don't!
Harl broke off as several of the other men pulled him back. They knew that Cal, who had been passing by chance, was the girl's best hope. Alim had already been sent to fetch Cal's father.
I can save her, Cal said.
Her face was pale and she didn't move. That head wound, maybe it...
Can't think about that.
One of the lower leg arteries was severed. He used his shirt to tie a tourniquet to stop the blood, but it kept slipping. Fingers still pressed against the cut, he called,
Fire! I need fire! Hurry! And someone give me your shirt!
Several men rushed off as Cal elevated the leg. One of the men hurriedly handed over his shirt. Cal knew where to pinch to cut off the artery. The tourniquet slipped, but his fingers did not. He held that artery closed, pressing the shirt on the rest of the wound until Valima came back with a candle's flame. They'd already begun heating a knife. Good. Cal took the knife, burning it into the wound, releasing the sharply pungent smell of scorched flesh. A cool wind blew across them, carrying it away. Cal's hands stopped shaking. He knew what to do. He moved with skill that surprised even him, perfectly cauterizing as his training took control. He still needed to tie off the artery. A cauterization might not hold on an artery this large, but the two together should work. When he was done, the bleeding had stopped. He sat back, smiling. And then he noticed that Miacel's head wound wasn't bleeding either. Her chest wasn't moving.
No!
Harl fell to his knees.
No! Do something!
I...
Cal said. He'd stopped the bleeding. He'd lost her. He didn't know what to say, how to respond. A deep, terrible sickness washed over him. Harl shoved him aside, wailing. Cal fell backward. He found himself shaking again as Harl clutched the corpse. Around them, the crowd was silent. An hour later, Cal sat on the steps in front of the surgery room, crying. It was a soft thing, his grief. A shake here, a few persistent tears slipping down his cheeks. He sat with knees up, arms wrapped around his legs, trying to figure out how to stop hurting. Was there a salve to take away this pain? A bandage to stop the flow from his eyes? He should have been able to save her. Footsteps approached, and a shadow fell on him. Liren knelt down beside him. I inspected your work, son. You did well. I'm proud.
I failed,
Cal whispered. His clothing was stained red. Before he'd washed the blood free of his hands, it had been scarlet. But soaked into his clothing, it was a duller reddish-brown. I've known men who practiced for hours and hours yet still froze when confronted by a wounded person. It's harder when it takes you by surprise. You didn't freeze. You went to her. Administered help. And you did it well.
I don't want to be a surgeon, Cal said. I'm terrible at it.
Liren sighed, rounding the steps, sitting down beside his son.
Cal, this happens. It's unfortunate, but you couldn't have done more. That little body lost blood too quickly.
Cal didn't reply.
You have to learn when to care, son, Liren said softly, and when to let go. You'll see. I had similar problems when I was younger. You'll grow calluses.
And is this a good thing? Cal thought, another tear trickling down his cheek.
You have to learn when to care, and when to let go.
In the distance, Harl continued to wail. Why Men Lie.
One need only look at the aftermath of his brief visit to Cell to see proof of what I say. Kaladin didn't want to open his eyes. If he opened his eyes, he'd be awake. And if he were awake, that pain, the burning in his side, the aching of his legs, the dull throb in his arms and shoulders, wouldn't be just a nightmare. It would be real, and it would be his. He stifled a groan, rolling onto his side. It all ached. Every length of muscle, every inch of skin. His head pounded. It seemed that his very bones were sore. He wanted to lie motionless and throbbing until Gaz was forced to come and tow him out by his ankles. That would be easy. Didn't he deserve to do what was easy for once? But he couldn't. To stop moving, to give up, would be the same as dying, and he could not let that happen. He'd made his decision already. He would help the Bridgemen.
Curse you, Hav, he thought. You can boot me out of my bunk even now.
Kaladin threw off his blanket, forcing himself to stand. The door to the barrack was cracked open to let in fresh air. He felt worse standing up, but the life of a Bridgeman wouldn't wait for him to recover. You either kept up or you got crushed. Kaladin steadied himself, hand against the unnaturally smooth, soul-cast rock of the barrack wall. He took a deep breath and crossed the room. Oddly, more than a few of the men were awake and sitting up. They watched Kaladin in silence.
They were waiting, Kaladin realized. They wanted to see if I'd get up.
He found the three wounded where he'd left them at the front of the barrack. He held his breath as he checked on Layton. Amazingly, he was still alive. His breathing was still shallow, his pulse weak, and his wounds dire, but he was alive. He wouldn't stay that way long without antiseptic. None of the wounds looked infected with Rotspren yet, but it would only be a matter of time in these dirty confines. He needed some of the apothecary's salves. But how? He checked the other two. Haber was smiling openly. He was round-faced and lean, with a gap between his teeth and short black hair.
Thank you, he said. Thank you for saving me.
Kaladin grunted, inspecting the man's leg.
You'll be fine, but you won't be able to walk for a few weeks. I'll bring food from the mess hall for you.
Thank you,
Haber whispered, taking Kaladin's hand, clutching it. He actually seemed to be tearing up. That smile forced back the gloom, made the aches and soreness fade. Kaladin's father had described that kind of smile. Those smiles weren't why Liren had become a surgeon, but they were why he'd remained one.
Rest, Kaladin said, and keep that wound clean. We don't want to attract any Rotspren. Let me know if you see any. They are small and red, like tiny insects.
Haber nodded eagerly, and Kaladin moved to dab it. The youthful Bridgeman looked just as he had the day before, staring forward, eyes unfocused.
He was sitting like that when I fell asleep, too, sir, Haber said. It's like he hasn't moved all night. Gives me the chills, it does.
Kaladin snapped his fingers in front of Dabbid's eyes. The man jumped at the sound, focusing on the fingers, following them as Kaladin moved his hand.
He's been hit in the head, I think, Hopper said.
No, Kaladin said. It's battle shock. It will wear off.
I hope.
If you say so, sir, Hopper said, scratching at the side of his head.
Kaladin stood and pushed the door open all the way, lighting the room. It was a clear day, the sun just barely over the horizon. Already, sounds drifted from the war camp, a blacksmith working early, hammer on metal. Chulls trumpeting in the stables. The air was cool, chilly, clinging to the vestiges of night. It smelled clean and fresh. Spring weather.
You got up, Kaladin told himself. Might as well get on with it.
He forced himself to go and do his stretches, body complaining at each motion. Then he checked his own wound. It wasn't too bad, though infection could make it worse.
Storm winds take that apothecary, he thought,
fetching a ladle full of water from the bridgeman barrel, using it to wash his wound. He immediately regretted the bitter thought against the elderly apothecary. What was the man to do? Give Kaladin the antiseptic for free? It was High Prince Sadius he should be cursing. Sadius was responsible for the wound and was also the one who had forbidden the surgeon's hall to give supplies to bridgemen, slaves, and servants of the lesser nouns. By the time he finished stretching, a handful of bridgemen had risen to get something to drink. They stood around the barrel regarding Kaladin. There was only one thing to do. Setting his jaw, Kaladin crossed the lumber grounds and located the plank he'd carried the day before. The carpenters hadn't yet added it to their bridge, so Kaladin picked it up and walked back to the barracks. Then he began practicing the same way he had yesterday. He couldn't go as fast. In fact, much of the time he could only walk. But as he worked, his aches soothed. His headache faded. His feet and shoulders still hurt, and he had a deep, latent exhaustion, but he didn't embarrass himself by falling over. In his practice, he passed the other bridgeman barracks. The men in front of them were barely distinguishable from those in Bridge 4. The same dark, sweat-stained leather vests over bare chests, or loosely tied shirts. There was the occasional foreigner, Thalens or Vadens most often, but they were unified in their scraggly appearances, unshaven faces, and haunted eyes. Several groups watched Kaladin with outright hostility. Were they worried that his practice would encourage their own bridge leaders to work them? He had hoped that some members of Bridge 4 might join his workout. They'd obeyed him during the battle, after all, even going so far as to help him with the wounded. His hope was in vain. While some bridgemen watched, others ignored him. None took part. Eventually Syl flitted down and landed on the end of his plank, riding like a queen on her palanquin.
"They're talking about you," she said as he passed the Bridge 4 barrack again.
"Not surprising," Kaladin said between puffs.
"Some think you've gone mad," she said. "Like that man who just sits and stares at the floor. They say the battle stress broke your mind."
"Maybe they're right. I didn't consider that."
"What is madness?"
she asked, sitting with one leg up against her chest, vaporous skirt flickering around her calves and vanishing into mist.
"It's when men don't think right," Kaladin said, glad for the conversation to distract him.
"Men never seem to think right."
"Madness is worse than normal," Kaladin said with a smile. "It really just depends on the people around you. How different are you from them? The person that stands out is mad, I guess."
"So you all just vote on it?"
she asked, screwing up her face.
"Well, not so actively. But it's the right idea."
She sat thoughtfully for a time longer.
"Kaladin,"
she finally said,
"why do men lie? I can see what lies are, but I don't know why people do it."
"Lots of reasons," Kaladin said, wiping the sweat from his brow with his free hand, then using it to steady the plank.
"Is it madness?"
"I don't know if I'd say that. Everyone does it."
"So maybe you're all a little mad,"
he chuckled.
"Yes, perhaps."
"But if everyone does it," she said, leaning her head on her knee, then the one who doesn't would be the one who is mad, right? Isn't that what you said earlier?
Well, I guess. But I don't think there's a person out there who hasn't ever lied.
Dalinar?
Who?
The king's uncle, Syl said. Everyone says he never lies. Your bridgemen even talk about it sometimes.
That's right. The Blackthorn. Kaladin had heard of him, even in his youth. He's a light eyes. That means he lies.
But...
they're all the same, Syl. The more noble they look, the more corrupt they are inside. It's all an act. He fell quiet, surprised at the vehemence of his bitterness.
Storm you, Amaram. You did this to me.
He'd been burned too often to trust the flame.
I don't think men were always this way,
she said absently, getting a far-off look in her face.
I...
Kaladin waited for her to continue, but she didn't. He passed Bridge 4 again. Many of the men relaxed, backs to the barrack wall, waiting for the afternoon shade to cover them. They rarely waited inside. Perhaps staying inside all day was too gloomy, even for bridgemen. Syl, he finally prompted. Were you going to say something?
It seems I've heard men talk about times when there were no lies.
There are stories, Kaladin said, about the times of the heraldic epics, when men were bound by honor. But you'll always find people telling stories about supposedly better days. You watch. A man joins a new team of soldiers, and the first thing he'll do is talk about how wonderful his old team was. We remember the good times and the bad ones, forgetting that most times are neither good nor bad. They just are. He broke into a jog. The sun was growing warm overhead, but he wanted to move. The stories, he continued between puffs, they prove it. What happened to the heralds? They abandoned us. What happened to the Knights Radiant? They fell and became tarnished. What happened to the Epic Kingdoms? They crashed when the Church tried to seize power. You can't trust anyone with power, Syl.
What do you do then? Have no leaders?
No. You give the power to the Light Eyes and leave it to corrupt them. Then try to stay as far from them as possible. His words felt hollow. How good a job had he done staying away from Light Eyes? He always seemed to be in the thick of them, caught in the muddy mire they created with their plots, schemes, and greed. Syl fell silent, and after that last jog, he decided to stop his practicing. He couldn't afford to strain himself again. He returned the plank. The carpenters scratched their heads, but didn't complain. He made his way back to the bridgemen, noticing that a small group of them, including Rock and Teft, were chatting and glancing at Kaladin. You know, Kaladin said to Syl, talking to you probably doesn't do anything for my reputation of being insane.
I'll do my best to stop being so interesting, Syl said, alighting on his shoulder.
She put her hands on her hips, then plopped down to a sitting position, smiling, obviously pleased with her comment. Before Kaladin could get back to the barrack, he noticed Gaz hustling across the lumberyard toward him.
You, Gaz said, pointing at Kaladin. Hold the season.
Kaladin stopped, waiting with folded arms.
I have news for you, Gaz said, squinting with his good eye. Brett Lloyd Lamoral heard what you did with the wounded.
How?
Storms, boy, Gaz said. You think people wouldn't talk? What were you going to do, hide three men in the middle of us all?
Kaladin took a deep breath, but backed down. Gaz was right. All right. What does it matter? We didn't slow the army.
Yeah, Gaz said. But Lamoral isn't too polished on the idea of paying and feeding bridgemen who can't work. He took the matter to High Prince Satius, intending to have you strung up.
Kaladin felt a chill. Strung up would mean hung out during a high storm for the Stormfather to judge. It was essentially a death sentence. And?
Right Lord Satius refused to let him do it, Gaz said.
What? Had he misjudged Satius? But no, this was part of the act.
Bright Lord Satius, Gaz said grimly, told Lamoral to let you keep the soldiers, but to forbid them food or pay while they're unable to work. Said it would show why he's forced to leave Bridgman behind.
That Kremling, Kaladin muttered. Gaz paled.
Hush, that's the High Prince himself you're talking about, boy.
He glanced about to see if anyone had heard. He's trying to make an example of my men. He wants the other Bridgman to see the wounded suffer and starve. He wants it to seem like he's doing a mercy by leaving the wounded behind.
Well, maybe he's right.
It's heartless, Kaladin said. He brings back wounded soldiers. He leaves the Bridgman because it's cheaper to find new slaves than it is to care for wounded ones. Gaz fell silent. Thank you for bringing me this news.
News? Gaz snapped. I was sent to give you orders, lordling. Don't try to get extra food from the mess hall for your wounded. You'll be refused.
With that, he rushed away, muttering to himself. Kaladin made his way back to the barrack. Stormfather. Where was he going to get food enough to feed three men? He could split his own meals with them, but while Bridgemen were kept fed, they weren't given in excess. Even feeding one man beyond himself would be a stretch. Trying to split the meals four ways would leave the wounded too weak to recover, and Kaladin too weak to run bridges. And he still needed antiseptic. Rotspren and disease killed far more men in war than the enemy did. Kaladin stepped up to the men lounging by the barrack. Most were going about the usual Bridgman activities, sprawled on the ground and despondently staring into the air, sitting and despondently staring at the ground, standing and despondently staring into the distance. Bridge 4 wasn't on bridge duty at all this day, and they didn't have work detail until third afternoon bell. Gaz says our wounded are to be refused food or pay until they are well, Kaladin said to the collected men. Some of them, Sigzil, Pete, Kulf, nodded as if this was what they'd expected. High Prince Satius wants to make an example of us, Kaladin said. He wants to prove that Bridgemen aren't worth healing, and he's going to do it by making Haber, Leighton, and Dabid die slow, painful deaths. He took a deep breath. I want to pool our resources to buy medicine and get food for the wounded. We can keep those three alive if a few of you will split your meals with them. We'll need about 24 or so clear marks to buy the right medicine and supplies. Who has something they can spare? The men stared at him. Then Moash started laughing. Others joined him. They waved dismissive hands and broke up, walking away, leaving Kaladin with his hand out.
Next time it could be you, he called. What will you do if you're the one that needs healing?
I'll die, Moash said, not even bothering to look back. Out on the field quickly, rather than back here over a week's time. Kaladin lowered his hand. He sighed, turning, and almost ran into Rock. The beefy tower-like horn-eater stood with arms folded, like a tan-skinned statue. Kaladin looked up at him, hopeful.
Don't have any spheres, Rock said with a grunt. Is all spent already.
Kaladin sighed.
It wouldn't have mattered anyway. Two of us couldn't afford to buy the medicine. Not alone.
I will give some food, Rock grumbled.
Kaladin glanced back at him, surprised.
But only for this man, with arrow in his leg, Rock said, arms still folded. He looks like he could get better. Other one, he will die, is certain. And I have no pity for man who sits there not doing anything. But for the other one, you may have my food, some of it.
Kaladin smiled, raising a hand and gripping the larger man's arm.
Thank you.
Rock shrugged.
You took my place. Without this thing, I would be dead.
Kaladin smirked at that logic.
I'm not dead, Rock. You'd be fine.
Rock shook his head.
I'd be dead. Is something strange about you. All men can see it, even if they don't want to speak of this thing. I looked at bridge where you were. Arrows hit all around you, beside your head, next to your hands. but they weren't hitting you. Luck is no such thing.
Rock glanced at Kaladin's shoulder.
Besides, there is Mafaliki who always follows you.
The large horn eater bowed his head reverently to Syl, then made a strange gesture with his hand, touching his shoulders and then his forehead. Kaladin started.
You can see her?
He glanced at Syl. As a windspren, she could appear to those she wanted to, and that generally only meant Kaladin. Syl seemed shocked. No, she hadn't appeared to Rock specifically.
I am Alai Iku, Rock said, shrugging.
Which means? Rock scowled.
Airsick lowlanders. Is there nothing proper you know? Anyway, you are special man. Bridge 4. It lost 8 runners yesterday, counting the 3 wounded.
I know, Kaladin said. I broke my first promise. I said I wasn't going to lose a single one. Rock snorted.
We are bridgemen. We die. Is how thing works. You might as well promise to make the moons catch each other.
The large man turned, pointing toward one of the other barracks.
Of the bridges that were fired upon, most lost many men. 5 bridges fell. They lost over 20 men each and needed soldiers to help get bridges back. Bridge 2 lost 11 men, and it wasn't even a focus of firing.
He turned back to Kaladin.
Bridge 4 lost 8. 8 men during one of the worst runs of the season. And perhaps you will save 2 of those. Bridge 4 lost fewest men of any bridge that the Parshendi tried to drop. Bridge 4 never loses fewest men. Everyone knows how it is.
Luck. Rock pointed a fat finger at him, cutting him off.
Airsick lowlander.
It was just luck. But, well, Kaladin would take it for the small blessing it was. No use arguing when someone had finally decided to start listening to him. But one man wasn't enough. Even if both he and Rock went on half rations, one of the sick men would starve. He needed spheres. He needed them desperately.
But he was a slave. It was illegal for him to earn money in most ways.
If only he had something he could sell. But he owned nothing. A thought occurred to him. Come on, he said, striding away from the barrack. Rock followed curiously. Kaladin searched through the lumberyard until he found Gaz, speaking with a bridge leader in front of Bridge 3's barrack. As was growing more common, Gaz grew pale when Kaladin approached and made as if to scurry away.
Gaz, wait,
Kaladin said, holding out his hand.
I have an offer for you.
The bridge sergeant froze. Beside Gaz, Bridge 3's leader shot Kaladin a scowl. The way the other bridgemen had been treating him suddenly made sense. They were perturbed to see Bridge 4 come out of a battle in such good shape. Bridge 4 was supposed to be unlucky. Everyone needed someone else to look down on, and the other bridge crews could be consoled by the small mercy that they weren't in Bridge 4. Kaladin had upset that. The dark-bearded bridge leader retreated, leaving Kaladin and Rock alone with Gaz.
What are you offering this time? Gaz said. More dun spheres?
No, Kaladin said, thinking quickly. This would have to be handled very carefully. I'm out of spheres. But we can't continue like this, you avoiding me, the other bridge crews hating me.
Don't see what we can do about it.
I tell you what, Kaladin said, as if suddenly having a thought. Is anyone on stone-gathering detail today?
Yeah,
Gaz said, gesturing over his shoulder.
Bridge 3. Bussek there was just trying to convince me that his team is too weak to go. Storms blast me, but I believe him. Lost 2/3 of his men yesterday, and I'll be the one who gets chewed out when they don't gather enough stones to meet quota.
Kaladin nodded sympathetically. Stone-gathering was one of the least desirable work details. It involved traveling outside of the camp and filling wagons with large rocks. Soulcasters fed the army by turning rocks into grain, and it was easier for them, for reasons only they knew, if they had distinct, separate stones.
so men gathered rocks. It was menial, sweaty, tiring, mindless work. Perfect for bridgemen.
Why don't you send a different bridge team? Kaladin asked.
Bah, Gaz said. You know the kind of trouble that makes? If I'm seen playing favorites, I never hear an end of the complaining.
Nobody will complain if you make Bridge 4 do it.
Gaz glanced at him, single eye narrowed.
I didn't think you'd react well to being treated differently.
I'll do it, Kaladin said, grimacing. Just this once. Look, Gaz, I don't want to spend the rest of my time here fighting against you.
Gaz hesitated.
Your men are going to be angry. I won't let them think it was me who did this to them.
I'll tell them it was my idea.
All right, then. Third bell, meet at the western checkpoint. Bridge 3 can clean pots.
He walked away quickly, as if to escape before Kaladin changed his mind. Rock stepped up beside Kaladin, watching Gaz.
The little man is right, you know. The men will hate you for this thing. They were looking forward to easy day.
They'll get over it.
But why change for harder work? It's true. You are crazy, aren't you?
Maybe. But that craziness will get us outside of the war camp.
What good is that?
It means everything, Kaladin said, glancing back at the barrack. It means life and death, but we're going to need more help.
Another bridge crew?
No. I mean that we, you and I, will need help. One more man, at least.
He scanned the lumberyard and noted someone sitting in the shadow of Bridge 4's barrack. Teft. The grizzled bridgeman hadn't been among the group that had laughed at Kaladin earlier, but he had been quick to help yesterday, going with Rock to carry Layton. Kaladin took a deep breath and strode out across the grounds, Rock trailing behind. Syl left his shoulder and zipped into the air, dancing on a sudden gust of wind. Teft looked up as Kaladin and Rock approached. The elder man had fetched breakfast and he was eating alone, a piece of flatbread peeking out beneath his bowl. His beard was stained by the curry, and he regarded Kaladin with wary eyes before wiping his mouth on his sleeve.
I like my food, son, he said. Hardly think they feed me enough for one man, let alone two.
Kaladin squatted in front of him. Rock leaned up against the wall and folded his arms, watching quietly.
I need you, Teft, Kaladin said.
I said, not your food, you. Your loyalty, your allegiance.
The elder man continued to eat. He didn't have a slave brand, and neither did Rock. Kaladin didn't know their stories. All he knew was that these two had helped when others hadn't. They weren't completely beaten down. Teft, Kaladin began.
I've given my loyalty before, the man said. Too many times now. Always works out the same.
Your trust gets betrayed? Kaladin asked softly.
Teft snorted.
Storms know. I betray it. You can't depend on me, son. I belong here as a bridgeman.
I depended on you yesterday and you impressed me.
Fluke.
I'll judge that, Kaladin said.
Teft, we're all broken in one way or another. Otherwise we wouldn't be bridgemen.
I've failed. My own brother died because of me. So why keep caring?
It's either that or give up and die.
And if death is better?
It came back to this problem. This was why the bridgeman didn't care if he helped the wounded or not.
Death isn't better, Kaladin said, looking Teft in the eyes.
Oh, it's easy to say that now, but when you stand on the ledge and look down into that dark, endless pit, you change your mind. Just like Hopper did. Just like I've done.
He hesitated, seeing something in the older man's eyes.
I think you've seen it too.
Aye, Teft said softly. I have.
So, are you with us in this thing?
Rock said, squatting down.
Us? Kaladin thought, smiling faintly. Teft looked back and forth between the two of them.
I get to keep my food?
Yes, Kaladin said. Teft shrugged.
All right then, I guess. Can't be any harder than sitting here and having a staring contest with mortality.
Kaladin held out a hand. Teft hesitated, then took it. Rock held out a hand.
Rock.
Teft looked at him, finished shaking Kaladin's hand, then took Rock's.
I'm Teft.
Stormfather, Kaladin thought. I'd forgotten that most of them don't even bother to learn each other's names.
What kind of name is Rock? Teft asked, releasing the hand. Is a stupid one, Rock said with an even face. But at least it has meaning. Does your name mean anything? I guess not, Teft said, rubbing his bearded chin. Rock, this is not my real name, the Horn-Eater admitted. It's just what lowlanders can pronounce. What's your real name, then? Teft asked. You won't be able to say it.
Teft raised an eyebrow.
Numuhuku Makiaki Ayalunamor, Rock said.
Teft hesitated, then smiled.
Well, I guess in that case, Rock will do just fine.
Rock laughed, settling down.
Our bridge leader has a plan. Something glorious and daring. Has something to do with spending our afternoon moving stones in the heat.
Kaladin smiled, leaning forward. We need to gather a certain kind of plant. A reed that grows in small patches outside the camp. Eyes, hands, or spheres? In case you have turned a blind eye to that disaster, know that Aeona and Sky are both dead, and that which they held has been splintered, presumably to prevent anyone from rising up to challenge Race. 2 days after the incident with the High Storm, Dalinar walked with his sons, crossing the rocky ground toward the King's Feasting Basin. Dalinar's storm wardens projected another few weeks of spring, followed by a return to summer. Hopefully it wouldn't turn to winter instead. I've been to 3 more leather workers, Adolin said softly. They have different opinions. It seems that even before the strap was cut, if it was cut, it was worn, so that's interfering with things. The best consensus has been that the strap was sliced, but not necessarily by a knife. It could have just been natural wear and tear. Dalinar nodded.
That's the only evidence that even hints there might be something odd about the girth breaking.
So we admit that this was just a result of the King's paranoia.
I'll talk to Elokar, Dalinar decided. Let him know we've run into a wall and see if there are any other avenues he'd like us to pursue.
That'll do. Adolin seemed to grow hesitant about something. Father, do you want to talk about what happened during the storm?
It was nothing that hasn't happened before.
But enjoy the evening, Adolin, Dalinar said firmly.
I'm all right. Perhaps it's good for the men to see what is happening. Hiding it has only inspired rumors, some of them even worse than the truth.
Adolin sighed but nodded. The king's feasts were always outdoors at the foot of Elokar's palace hill. If the storm wardens warned of a high storm, or if more mundane weather turned bad, then the feast was cancelled. Dalinar was glad for the outdoor location. Even with ornamentation, soul-cast buildings felt like caverns. The feast basin had been flooded, turning it into a shallow, artificial lake. Circular dining platforms rose like small stone islands in the water. The elaborate miniature landscape had been fabricated by the king's soulcasters who had diverted the water from a nearby stream.
It reminds me of Selatales, Dalinar thought as he crossed the first bridge.
He'd visited that western region of Roshar during his youth.
And the Pure Lake.
There were 5 islands, and the railings of the bridges connecting them were done in scrollwork so fine that after each feast,
The railings had to be stowed away, lest a high storm ruin them. Tonight, flowers floated in the slow current. Periodically, a miniature boat, only a handspan wide, sailed past, bearing an infused gemstone. Dalinar, Inarin, and Adolin stepped onto the first dining platform.
"One cup of blue," Dalinar said to his sons. "After that, keep to the orange."
Adolin sighed audibly.
"Couldn't we, just this once?"
"So long as you are of my house, you follow the codes. My will is firm, Adolin."
"Fine," Adolin said. "Come on, Renarin."
The two broke off from Dalinar to remain on the first platform, where the younger light eyes congregated. Dalinar crossed to the next island. This middle one was for the lesser light eyes. To its left and right lay the segregated dining islands, men's island on the right, women's island on the left. On the three central ones, however, the genders mingled. Around him, the favored invitees took advantage of their king's hospitality. Soulcast food was inherently bland, but the king's lavish feasts always served imported spices and exotic meats. Dalinar could smell roasting pork on the air, and even chickens. It had been a long time since he'd been served meat from one of the strange Shin flying creatures. A dark-eyed servant passed, wearing a gauzy red robe and carrying a tray of orange crab legs. Dalinar continued across the island, weaving around groups of revelers. Most drank violet wine, the most intoxicating and flavorful of the colors. Almost no one was in battle attire. A few men wore tight, waist-length jackets, but many had dropped all pretense, choosing instead loose silk shirts with ruffled cuffs worn with matching slippers. The rich material glistened in the lamplight. These creatures of fashion shot glances at Dalinar, appraising him, weighing him.